From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour focuses on the classroom, how to make teachers more effective, or how to improve education and student performance. Well, listen to this particular criticism. Class sizes are too large, making it difficult for any teacher to be effective. Teacher salaries are too low, making it difficult for school districts to keep the most talented teachers. Teachers could not be expected to happily take far less pay than they're worth. Does that sound familiar? This line of argument came from an essay in The Atlantic in 1875. Yes, much of that same essay was a sexist screed that focused on the ostensible frailties of female teachers, but the core arguments about class size and teacher salary are right there, and they haven't gone away 14 decades later. That was just one of the many valuable lessons I learned in reading Dana Goldstein's new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Goldstein is an acclaimed journalist whose work appears in Slate, The Atlantic, The Nation, and other publications, and she joins us live for the hour. Dana, good afternoon.
Thank you so much, Evan. I loved your introduction.
Well, the book is, and I try to be as objective as I can, and I know in many ways, as before your epilogue, you said the same thing in your own book, but I have to say it's a remarkable achievement because throughout the book, which is out today right now, I should say for our listeners, throughout the book, you take us on a walk through history and draw modern parallels without ever seeming partisan, but wanting us to understand context. And so often we don't have the context. And I have to say, Dana, in many ways, the book depressed me because so often I learned that what seems like a new idea or a new initiative is just sort of a blandly recycled old idea that didn't work very well.
Yeah, I mean, people say that the first 8 or 9 chapters of the book are depressing, but I hope that the end of the book is optimistic and uplifting, because as much as we've tried the same failed ideas over and over again, there are some wonderful ideas for making schools and teachers more effective that we've never actually tried.
And I should say, depressing but fascinating. I mean, so many really interesting sort of historical vignettes and people you never knew were teachers. Dana, kind of gives you these little profiles as well. But so much of it's so valuable to our modern discussion. And let me give you an example of just one very recent idea that seems and was billed as something very new and revolutionary. You briefly wrote about the Zuckerberg, Chris Christie, Cory Booker juggernaut that announced on the Oprah Winfrey show in 2010 they were going to take $100 million and reform Newark public schools. And you write that the donation, alongside matching funds from other philanthropists, has supported mostly familiar policies. That wasn't the big tagline we got at the time. We got this promise of revolution in public schools.
Yeah, so it supported a lot of attempts to tie teacher evaluation to student test scores. We know that federal dollars are going toward the same thing, so we can't really, I think at this point, consider that an innovation any longer. We've been trying it for a while. It actually dates back to the 1920s, that idea. It went to support charter schools, another idea that already had big philanthropic backing before Zuckerberg came onto the scene. And then it went to support some early childhood literacy programs. That's a great idea, but as I write in my book, there was already philanthropic support for a successful early childhood literacy program in Newark before Zuckerberg came onto the scene. So when you take a look at the record of that specific attempt in Newark, New Jersey, to be very bold and innovative, you see that the money was flowing toward ideas that were not new at all.
The book's called The Teacher Wars. It's out today. If you have a child in school, if you are a teacher, if you know a teacher, or if you care about public schools, the book really is for you. It's just a wonderful history lesson, and we can't get through everything, but what I'm going to do is sort of structure the interview in a way that looks at some of Dana's ideas in terms of what you have learned in your own reporting, Dana, and possible policy applications going forward, how it weaves into history. And if our listeners want to join the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, Dana, part of the history of America's schools and America's teachers is that our schools have been segregated, and that presents its own challenges. And you wrote about a speech that Ronald Reagan gave in 1984 in Charlotte when he did not receive the response he expected. He was talking about schools and the way Charlotte was looking at integration. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So Ronald Reagan is running for re-election, and he's talking in front of a group of mostly white people in Charlotte. and he says, look, we tried busing to desegregate our schools, and it failed. It took children out of the community, and nobody wanted this, and it's a failed policy. And he's expecting to get a really hearty round of applause. And actually what happens is the crowd is totally silent. And the reason why is that school desegregation, contrary to how it's often depicted, was actually quite popular in many of the southern regions that implemented it. Student achievement in Charlotte actually went up for both white and black children during the years of desegregation, but you really see an ideological commitment from the Reagan administration to roll back this progress. And what they do is they appoint judges who start to overturn school desegregation orders. And what we have today is that our schools are more segregated by race and class than they were on the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And we see that in places where segregation increases, where children are separated from one another, that that negatively impacts student achievement.
Yeah, give me a sense for what was it, 2002 to 2011 was the best data we have post desegregation in Charlotte. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So what happened is as the schools resegregated, as black schools became more black, as majority white schools became more white, you see this flow of effective educators out of the black schools and toward the white schools. And one of the really disturbing things about this is that not only does this decrease student test scores, but the teachers that are leaving the black schools to go to the white schools even include black teachers, and especially include black teachers who had been particularly effective with black students. So what we see is that teachers are expressing a preference to work in an integrated setting, and unfortunately our policies are not set up to create more of these integrated schools. So what we see is that the teacher quality movement, which was supposed to replace the integration movement, in fact, it's best when these two things can work together, but they haven't been. They've sort of been set in contest with one another.
On this program, we have talked about Wake County, North Carolina. There's a delegation from the Rochester area that's gone down to Wake County, North Carolina, and they did a kind of integration project starting in 1976 with rather effective results. But here in Rochester, there's a big difference to Wake County. Wake County had a largely minority urban school district and then a largely white countywide school district. So you're essentially merging two districts. Here in Monroe County, for example, there are 19 districts mm-hmm. in Monroe County alone. So what's the lesson? How can you expect to change school segregation going forward?
Yeah, well, it's really tough in the North, especially in states like New York. I grew up in New York. I also live in New York. We have very, very small school districts here, and that makes integration really tough, right? Because residential segregation, housing segregation forms school segregation. Unfortunately, what the Supreme Court decided is that suburban districts in the North don't have any responsibility to partner with urban districts. So that makes it harder. However, one of the things that has been tried really successfully in Boston is magnet schools. So a magnet school would open up in the city with a special theme, say science and math or performing arts, and they would open that up, enrollment in that school to suburban kids. And when suburban kids would take the bus to that school, space would open up in the suburban high school and urban kids would go out. And this is totally a choice-based system, which is really important. We know one of the reasons why desegregation was unpopular was because people were getting bused to and fro without their permission and they didn't want to go. But when we can create these policies built around choice, they have more success.
My guest for the hour is author Dana Goldstein. The book is The Teacher Wars. It is out today. Now, a couple of points there. You mentioned in looking at Charlotte, for example, that some of the effective educators moved around after sort of the end of desegregation in 2002. And that implies we really know how to target effective teachers. But part of the book that you confess and you read about the struggle over the years to define what an effective teacher is and what the metrics should be. So do you want to sort of just back up and explain when you talk about effective teachers, for example, in Charlotte or effective teachers in general, how you sort of define that?
Today, the biggest way to measure the effectiveness of a teacher is to look at student outcomes. So sometimes that's a student score on a standardized test. Sometimes it's how likely the child is to graduate high school, how likely the child is to enroll in college, even how likely the child is to not become a teen parent. So these are all ways that researchers have used to measure the effectiveness of a teacher. A lot of this is new, but not all of it. Going back to the 1920s, we do do see these attempts to measure teachers based on student test scores. But also throughout American history, we see lots of ways to measure how good teachers are at their job. During World War I and World War II, principals would check to see if teachers were being patriotic enough in their lessons, if they were, you know, supporting the war effort. In the 70s, there was a lot of attention paid to teachers' sort of personality traits, whether they were warm, whether they were extroverted. So there's a shifting conversation about what effective teaching looks like.
And I know our listeners are wondering what effective teachers are in regards to standardized tests. Dana absolutely tackles that in her book, The Teacher Wars. We're going to be getting to that a little bit later in the hour here. And one of the common questions when it comes to desegregation of schools, Dana, is that, is it a zero-sum game or not? And if the education is going to be better for kids from impoverished homes, is it going to get worse for kids who otherwise had sort of the safe suburban education?
Well, you know, how would that happen? How would it be that making it better for poor children would make it worse for suburban kids? What's the argument?
I take the point on the question, but I think, but that's a common question that we've heard even on this program. That, you know,
yeah.
You're saying the evidence doesn't support that contention.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. I mean, we do know that when schools are balanced between middle class and poor children, that all the kids do well, and it doesn't bring down the scores of the middle class kids to be attending school with poor children. However, once it gets to the point where maybe about 60 or 70% of the kids are living in poverty, that does have an effect. And the reason why is because the school becomes overwhelmed with dealing with the challenges of poverty that children bring with them from home into the classroom. So that is somewhat of a fair point. If you're talking about deeply, deeply impoverished schools, that does impact student achievement.
Let's get our first call here. We have Dana Goldstein, the author of The Teacher Wars, with us. This is Paul in Henrietta. Paul, thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. I appreciate your guest's achievement. I look forward to reading the book. I started teaching secondary school in 1975. Did some suburban schools, some inner city schools, some rural schools, some private school. I've been quite well traveled in the various systems of education. I would offer the following as a possible help, given the really pathetic situation in Rochester's, most of Rochester's city schools. And that is that the big problem, as people are now saying, is how do you get the kids to show up? As they grow older, they disappear by the hundreds, and the attendance rates fall down sometimes below 50% in these troubled high schools. The example of East High School has been all over the news. I suggest and have actually proposed programs that we're in the process of trying to do something with, that kids who are in bad, difficult home lives and difficult poverty situations, difficult neighborhoods, that the after-school possibilities of programs that not only invigorate them artistically or athletically, but also offer them comfort and little homework assistance and things of that nature. If you start offering that somewhere late in elementary or early junior high, and you don't restrict it to those kids that are already succeeding, but rather cater it to those kids that are having trouble, you're going to raise the level of attendance and the level of interest in actually working with things like language and teamwork and cooperative learning that kids often don't get very much of in inner city classrooms because you're busy just trying to manage the chaos.
And Paul, let me jump in and say, first of all, thank you for the call. And let me also say a programming note for our listeners. We're going to have Dr. Bolhan Vargas on this program, the superintendent of Rochester Schools, later this week, talking about exactly that, the question of truancy and getting kids to school. Dana, thoughts on what he had to say there?
Yeah, I love what the caller said. One of the interesting things in my research on the history of teaching is going back to the 19th century, you see these visionary educators like a woman named Ella Flagg Young, who was the first female superintendent of a public school system in Chicago, or Anna Julia Cooper, who is an African-American teacher at the turn of the century in Washington, D.C. They come to the same conclusion as the caller, and they talk about wraparound or community services for kids, the idea that kids need help after school, the teacher needs to be aware of the child's family life, that factors like language skill and healthcare and nutrition are all central to how a child learns. We see a conversation today around that when you look at the Harlem Children's Zone, which is a project here in New York City, which is very popular with national reformers. It's all about taking a look at the child's, you know, whole socioeconomic status, everything about that kid, not just what goes on in the classroom. This is a very effective form of education reform. Unfortunately, it's also one of the most expensive, which makes it difficult to do well.
We're going to be getting to some of your comments as well on Twitter, and I see them lining up there. So if you've had a comment or a question, we're going to do our best to get to them this hour with Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, a book that is out today. So if you're on the phone or waiting, we're going to get you in just a second. A question on an easy policy prescription that you offer in this book, Dana, which is that you write that in 2012, the median teacher income of American teachers was $54,000. Similar to police officers, librarians, etc. Now, in South Korea, for example, teachers are paid more like doctors or engineers, earning up to $155,000. And you write that the evidence shows better student outcomes are absolutely associated with higher teacher pay. If that's true, what are we waiting for? Shouldn't this be an easy policy point?
You'd think it would be, and yet it's so unpopular, and it's never discussed in our political conversation, which is so frustrating. But one of the things that I suggest is, without, you know, raising taxes and putting a whole bunch of new dollars into the system, we could restructure the pay teachers already get so that they get more of it earlier in their career. So, for example, in New York City, if you work for 5 years, you only get a $5,000 raise, no matter how great of a teacher you are. In North Carolina, you have to work 15 years to get a $10,000 raise from $30,000 to $40,000. And these are sort of bad incentives. I mean, teachers getting into their late 20s, early 30s, mid-30s, making decisions about buying a home or starting a family, are in this very flat situation where they don't have a lot of pay raises that they can look forward to. And as a result, I think, you know, a lot of great people choose to either leave the profession or they don't come into the classroom in the first place. So we need to make sure we're restructuring the teacher pay schedule so that they can look forward to more raises when they're younger.
It seems obvious, but what do politicians say about that?
Well, you know, a lot of times, instead of kind of just doing this across the board for all teachers, they want to tie the raises, particularly the student test scores, which is not something that I support. I think across the board we need to restructure teacher pay, and that's one of the things that we can do to get better people into the profession. And, you know, to show teachers that policymakers believe in them, that we're not pursuing these merit pay strategies just to cut budgets. If you look at the history of merit pay, a lot of times when a district institutes it, the overall amount of money paid to teachers goes down. So merit pay is discussed as this wonderful accountability strategy, and sometimes, unfortunately, it can be used as a budget-cutting strategy.
How far back does the debate about merit pay go in this country?
Well, it goes back at least to about 1915. I found it in Atlanta in 1915, more discussions of it in the 1920s and 1930s. It was extremely popular. Again, in the early 1960s, there was a little burst of energy around merit pay, and once again in the early 1980s. So it is cyclical. It comes back again and again.
And here's Marco writing in saying, I would support giving teachers six-figure salaries if they would give up some of their union benefits and pensions. What do you think, Dana?
Yeah, you hear that a lot. One of the conclusions I make in the book is that it does make sense for teachers to have some more tenure and due process protections than other professions. The reason why I draw that conclusion is because from looking at the history of this job, you see again and again that teachers are attacked for reasons that have nothing to do with their competence in the classroom. Even today, I interviewed teachers in Los Angeles who were removed from their jobs because they opposed the administration's reform agenda. They were asking questions about standardized test prep. They were asking questions about why their school didn't have new computers. teaching is political, and I do believe that teachers deserve a little bit of extra protection. That said, I don't think tenure can mean in practice that it's so expensive and so difficult to remove a teacher that a principal is basically scared to even attempt to do this. So I think the process needs to be made more efficient and streamlined.
And there's a few other prescriptions you have when it comes to union protections. We're going to get to those a little bit later in this hour. Paul, we're coming to you next on the phone, but let me just ask a follow-up question because Joseph here on Twitter, Joseph is writing asking your thoughts on the recent attacks on teachers. You kind of talk about some of those attacks that might not have anything to do with competency. He also wants to know about modern efforts to privatize public education. And as an extension of that, I was just going to ask you, here in Rochester, the new mayor has shown some support for charter schools. What does the evidence tell us about, for example, privatization of public school or charter schools? Does it work, and what's the track record?
Yeah, well, privatization of public schools, there are for-profit charter schools around the country. We don't really have them in New York. They exist in places like Michigan, for example. Charter schools in general, whether they're nonprofit, like the majority of public schools, public charter schools, or for-profit, they're about average. Some of them are better than public schools, and some are the same, and some are worse. So I don't think we can broadly generalize about the charter school sector. In terms of privatization, what I will say is that corporate philanthropists, like Bill Gates, for example, have taken a very great interest in public education, and many of their assumptions and priorities are shaping the debate. But whether that's leading to privatization of the system or rather just the infusion of business-type ideas into public education, that's something a lot of people are debating.
We're talking to author Dana Goldstein, whose new book is The Teacher Wars. It's out today. This is Paul in Irondequoit. Paul, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
What I'd like to say is, here's what I see, and I don't mean to talk negative about the woman's comments at all. When I'm out early in the morning, I see the lights on in the houses, the kids running around and everything else, and it's very early. It's very early for them to get ready to be bused. And then they get to school, they got to have their breakfast, and which is understandable, they got to have some food, and then you know, they get the bus back. I see a big problem with this, and the reason being is the amount of time and effort that these kids have to put in, particularly what they call the at-risk kids, you know, with no parental support, is tremendous, and I don't think it can be accomplished. The other thing I think is, I notice in the larger metropolitan areas that I go to, most of your public vehicles are being run on natural gas now. And I think if they was to actually switch over to natural gas when they're ordering new buses, the cost savings could be put into education. I really think that the bus system is really taking a lot of funding away from the effort in the schools.
All right, Paul, thanks for the call. It's a little farther afield away from teaching, but Dana, quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I was bused, so I don't necessarily think it takes as much out of a child's day as the caller assumes. However, what I will say is that it has been found to be cost-effective in terms of the impact on student achievement, and also what I would support are busing systems that are choice-based. So parents and kids and families would have the decision whether or not to participate in these choice-based systems. It's not something that would be forced upon any family.
The book is out today. It's called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Author and journalist Dana Goldstein on the line with us for the hour. We're going to take the shortest break in radio, and we're going to come back and find out more about what she thinks her research has shown. Where are the open windows for better policies? What are the openings that will allow us to have sort of a better and more harmonious relationship between unions and public officials and teachers? What are some of the union protections that are outdated? What is LIFO? Things like that. And what about standardized tests? How do they return to their rightful role as diagnostic tools? Dana Goldstein explains that and more when we come back on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we preview the People's Climate March that will unfold in New York City later this month. Some of the organizers join us in studio to talk about the impact they hope to have when the UN addresses climate change. What reasonable policy changes are in their sights? What do they want governmental bodies to do? Join the conversation with us next hour on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Join us for a day of fun and discovery during WXXI's Open House, Saturday, September 13th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Come meet your favorite PBS characters, take a tour of the station, and learn how to live a healthier life with free health screenings. For more information, go public at WXXI.org/openhouse.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Dana Goldstein, you write about union protections, and again, you've mentioned that tenure, you think, has more justification than some others, like LIFO, for example. What is LIFO and how does it work?
LIFO is last in, first out. So it's basically exactly what it sounds like. If a school is having budget cuts and they need to reduce the teaching force because of that, it basically dictates that the senior-most teachers are protected and the youngest and least experienced teachers are let go. And the conclusion I came to in my research is that now that we know so much more about what effective teaching looks like, it doesn't really make sense to use seniority as the only factor. Instead, seniority should be a tiebreaker when teachers are of varying levels of effectiveness.
But, you know, again, part of the argument is that it is difficult to assess a teacher's quality, and unions say that without LIFO, good older teachers can be unfairly targeted.
Well, I don't think I don't agree with the idea that it's impossible to assess a teacher's quality. I think the best way to assess it is by having a great instructional leader and an effective principal actually go into the teacher's classroom and see what the teacher is doing. We come up with a lot of complex ways in this country to evaluate teachers' work, a lot of complicated mathematical formulas, value-added measurement that looks at kids' test scores. What I argue for is something simpler, something that really looks at how the teacher is engaging with students in the classroom, whether the students are responding to that. Does the teacher know his or her subject matter? So I reject the idea that it's impossible to tell the difference between an effective and an ineffective teacher.
We can obsess about teachers, but we hear less discussion about school principals. You would change that. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think the principal is sort of the most important figure in school reform that we rarely ever talk about. We know that when we ask teachers, what would inspire you to take a job with a higher poverty student population? So what would really inspire you to take the toughest job in the system? They uniformly will pretty much say, I want to work for a really great principal. But right now, only about a third of teachers are saying in urban schools that their principal is someone that they really love and respect. So I think having principals be sort of visionary leaders, people who are truly focused on effective instruction and who are expert educators themselves, I think this really has the potential to bring the best teachers to the kids who most need them.
One of your policy ideas is designed to ward off the kind of the malaise that can come with doing really any job the same, same way, same day, year after year. You want to keep teaching interesting, and your suggestion looks to two interesting places for guidance, Singapore and Baltimore. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so both in Singapore and Baltimore, if you're a great teacher and you've been doing the job for a couple of years, you have the opportunity to become a mentor and a leader. So in Baltimore, you have teachers being used as peer evaluators, so they would watch videos of their colleagues' classrooms and help their colleagues get better at their jobs. And then in Singapore, teachers are given the option to go onto a track for leadership either in curriculum development, such as writing textbooks, in education policy, so advising the political system about how schools are run, or in instruction and peer mentorship. So, you know, after 5 years or so, if a teacher is really showing that they excel at this work, it shouldn't look, the job shouldn't look the same every single day as it did their first year on the job. Teachers, like everybody else, they want to be recognized as leaders in the adult world and have opportunity to lead not just among kids, but also with adults.
Now let's talk a little bit about standardized tests and evaluations. And you want to return tests to, quote, their rightful role as diagnostic tools. And that's a tough one. How would you do that? I mean, obviously, let's start with the fact that you agree with many of the complaints that we are obsessed with standardized testing. And I'm trying to remember, there was one school, where was it, in Colorado, where there's something like 25 days of testing for the average student at the district you visited?
Yeah, and actually that's not unusual. I mean, there's plenty of school districts where kids are spending 25, 30 days per year testing and even more time devoted to test prep. The reason why this is happening is because all the federal incentives that are flowing towards states and school districts that agree to evaluate teachers using kids' test scores. So basically the conclusion I came to is I looked at the way test prep was becoming the de facto curriculum in many schools, and I conclude that although tests are really useful research tools, they're useful for diagnosing what kids do and don't know, and they're useful for seeing how teachers are doing teaching this material, they should not be built into these accountability systems, because what happens is when you tie rewards and punishments for adults to these tests for kids, the entire school day becomes oriented around helping kids to do better on these multiple choice tests.
And we also occasionally, and I'm not saying this is widespread, but occasionally we get reports of test results being changed or altered.
Adult cheating, and I cover that in depth in Chapter 9 of the book. I mean, from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta to plenty of school districts here in New York State, unfortunately we do see adults tampering with these student answer sheets because adult incentives are being tied to this. Now, of course, that's completely unethical and illegal behavior, and we can't say that that's, you know, oh, it's okay because the incentive systems. No, it's totally unacceptable. But we need to look at why these bad apples are able to get away with this, and it's because we've set up these systems.
And one of our callers who wanted to call in and ask off the air a question just in general about your thoughts on teacher evaluations in New York State. Again, I know you're a national journalist. You live in New York State. You've been talking about the fact that teacher evaluations tied to these test scores is a bad idea in your view. But any other thoughts on teacher evaluations in general?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the big challenges is what we do with the two-thirds of teachers who don't teach a tested grade or subject. So that's your kindergarten teacher, your first grade teacher, your art teacher, your music teacher. And that's absolutely a challenge here in New York and in many of the other states I visited as a reporter. And we see states and school districts trying different things. So Florida is actually going to create assessments for every single subject, including arts, including music. In Colorado, I saw first graders and kindergartners sitting down to take multiple choice tests in their art class. In New York, we're seeing something called shared attribution, where, for example, the art teacher would be held responsible for the reading test scores. I think all of these policies, unfortunately, are a little bit misguided.
If you want to join the conversation with author Dana Goldstein, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. The Teacher Wars, the book, is out today. And part of the history lesson is that there was this shift that happened, and we're talking well over 100 years ago now, of many more men to many more women being teachers. You think it's important to get more men and people of color back into the teaching ranks, but let's go back a little bit to what shifted that balance early on, Dana.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people don't realize that in 1800, 90% of American teachers were actually men. And today we know 76% of teachers are women, so it's sort of a head-scratcher. How did this happen? And the reason is that in the 1830s, when school reformers were passing laws to make education compulsory, so forcing parents to enroll their kids in schools, they needed a way to do this without raising taxes too much, which was as unpopular back then as it is now. And what they settled on was recruiting women teachers to do the job. This allowed reformers to open up a lot more schools because they could get away with paying women about half as much as they could pay men back then.
It's shocking in a way, though, that there was sort of this acquiescence that, at least it felt to me like, you know, Beecher and other figures of the time, it just seemed to be this acceptance that women would make less and this is a good way to do it. And I found that part of the account shocking.
Yeah, it's really not until about the 1850s that feminists like Susan B. Anthony start raising the question of why women teachers are paid less than men. Originally, you mentioned Catherine Beecher. She was Harriet Beecher Stowe's sister, and they come from this strong abolitionist and social reformist family. Catherine Beecher was one of the first people who spread this idea that it was okay for middle-class women to take a job outside the home and that job should be teaching. She was just so thrilled that she was giving women an option other than marriage and being a housewife that she didn't even think about very much about the pay. In fact, she argued that it was good that women teachers would be making less. because it would be cheaper for the towns and the states to educate the kids. So you're right. It takes a while for this argument about gender pay discrimination to come to the fore.
And in many ways, I guess that was born out of good intention there, but it was a terrible position in the long run for Beecher to take. I mean, it set women in this terrible position, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, basically the argument she made is that teaching is just like being a...
Hold on, we lost Dana for just a second, and I'll ask our engineer, John, if he noticed that. Dana, if you're still there, hang on. And John, can you hear? We lost Dana for a second, and I think what happened was we were moving the phone lines around. John, we've lost Dana. So I will remind you that our guest for the hour is Dana Goldstein, the author of The Teacher Wars, her new book that is out today. John, engineer, can you hear me? We've lost Dana. I don't know where Dana is, so we'll have to go ahead and try to reestablish the connection. If you're just joining us, there it is here. So let's go ahead and dump that there. Okay. Dana Goldstein's the author of The Teacher Wars, the book that's out today that takes this historical look at the history of education reform in this country, and not just the history of education reform, but in so many ways, the ways it ties into the modern movements. I mean, if you think about Race to the Top, for example, think about No Child Left Behind, Teach for America, just about everything that you could find in terms of modern reform movement is tied to a previously incarnated idea or effort that goes back years, and unfortunately, most of them have not worked very well. And so that's why I opened the interview with saying that in many ways the book depressed me, because it felt like all these ideas that seemed that were ostensibly new were not that new, and that they had failed before, and that they were sort of destined to fail again. But she ends the book in the epilogue with policy prescriptions of her own, that she goes from sort of an objective reporter and an observer of history to saying, look, here are the lessons of 200 years, and here's what we can change going forward. Here's where we have opportunities to make these work. And part of that is recruiting more men and people of color to the teaching profession. And that's no offense to women. It's just a look at historically why things went in that direction, why we had so many women teaching. So let me get Dana back on the line here. Dana, sorry about that.
Oh, no, it's okay. Here I am. Sorry.
Thank you for that. And now we've got the phones just about packed here. So let's grab a few calls here. And if you want to join the program, you can do that by phone. And we also have comments coming in online. This is Pete. He's been waiting. Go ahead, Pete.
Yes, good morning. It's truly unfortunate that when we discuss this issue, we say it's public schools that are a problem. It's not public schools. It's urban and rural public schools. Suburban public schools are doing just fine because it also corresponds with the evidence that has been clear that success of the student is tied to family income and education. You talked about teachers being forced to take cuts in pay and benefit. That's a direct connection to the loss of middle-class income in this country. The jobs that were pulled out from under the middle class with free trade. People can't afford to take care of themselves, let alone their families, and pay taxes to compensate teachers for the job that is required. It's just disturbing that we continue to look at these ideas. Oh, we've got a new idea for education. It's not a new idea. And even if it was a perfect idea, if the idea is undercapitalized, it's doomed to fail. Just like families without adequate income, you cannot expect those families and those children to succeed without adequate income.
All right, Pete, thanks for the call. Dana, first of all, response to his comments there.
Yeah, I mean, he's making a very fair point, and it's another one that I also make in the book. We expect teachers to be sort of warriors in this fight against poverty and inequality in the United States, and yet we expect them to do that when we have a really weak social safety net compared to other Western countries. We don't, you know, debate that much raising the minimum wage. Instead, we focus on how we evaluate teachers. So it's a very fair point. We know only about 7% of the current achievement gap between poor and middle-class kids is driven by teaching disparities. The rest of it comes from the family. It comes from socioeconomic status. Those are all extremely fair points to make.
And here's Philip online saying, I might have missed it. She mentioned raising teacher salaries, but is there a structure to figure out exactly how much teachers should be paid? Dana?
I mean, in terms of how much teachers should be paid, one of the things we know is that in other nations, for example, like South Korea, teachers make about the same as engineers. here in the United States, we know that there's a huge pay disparity between what a teacher can earn as a teacher and in another job that they may also be qualified to do. So rather than look at the raw number, I think it's interesting to note, you know, what are the other professions a teacher might be considering, say a public interest attorney, an engineer for those with math and science backgrounds, and use those as guidelines for teacher salary.
Let me grab Seth. Seth, thanks for calling Connections. You're on with author Dana Goldstein. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I think one of the main problems why kids, specifically black kids, are not learning in school is because there is not a great emphasis placed on the value of education in their home. Okay? That's the biggest problem. And the question needs to be asked is this. How do you get black kids to be interested in going to school and gaining a meaningful education? That's the question that needs to be asked. All the other stuff they're doing, those are just band-aid type of approach. It's not going to work. You have to get the kids to be interested in getting an education. That's the way it was when I was in school, okay? And I'm almost 60 years old, and it has worked so far. That's Seth, all I have to say.
Yeah, Seth, thanks for the call. Dana, his comment reminds me, and again, I wish I had the page in your book. There was a part of your book where you referenced an unscientific but revealing survey of, I think maybe it was in Chicago, 500 kids and something like 400 plus said that they would rather go to hard labor work than go to school, and that school was drudgery and that there was essentially no interest. I mean, that's what his comment is reminding me of, and that goes back, was it 100 years old, I think that survey was, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I'm impressed that you remember that from the book. It took place in Chicago at the turn of the century, and they were asking poor children, would you rather work in a factory, in a really dangerous factory, or would you rather go to school? And kids at the time said they hated school, they would rather work. And we actually see very similar survey results today when we survey our kids that are dropping out of high school. So in terms of answer to the question of how we get high-poverty Black and Latino kids to get interested in school, one of the traditions I trace in the book is the African-American pedagogical or teaching tradition that dates all the way back to the Civil War. And we see that Black educators like W.B. Du Bois, Anna Julia Cooper, these are true visionaries who have wonderful ideas of how to get Black children engaged in their education. They focus on things like the importance of school discipline and good behavior, and also relationships between the parents and the teachers. This is something that comes up again and again, is important for the Black community in particular, and I look at those ideas closely in the book.
Absolutely. The book's called The Teacher Wars by Dana Goldstein. It's out now, and along those lines of just simply having teachers who inspire students to want to be there. Again, if you missed a part of our discussion earlier, Dana has policy prescriptions in the epilogue of the book, and some of those include keeping teachers stimulated, keeping teachers interested. Dana, when you talk to teachers about these policy prescriptions, I know you've worked with many and you've observed many. What's the response you're getting from the teaching community?
I'm hearing really great things from teachers. I mean, in part, a lot of them have not had the chance to learn much about the history of the profession. One of the things that they're telling me is interesting about the book is learning that people like President Lyndon Johnson and Susan B. Anthony and Herman Melville, the author, these people who are teachers teach about, they may not realize that they were actually teachers themselves. And that their stories are pretty interesting, what they found when they were actually in the classroom. Another idea that I have in the book that I think teachers kind of instinctively like is the idea that we should look to teachers for leadership, that we can look to the best teachers to show us what needs to be happening in the system across the board. We don't always need to look to the Bill Gateses to get new ideas. Like, some of the best ideas come from educators themselves.
Yeah, and that is the most common critique I hear of the Common Core, which is that it was crafted essentially outside the educational community. You think that's fair criticism?
Well, the teachers' unions were certainly on board with the crafting of the Common Core. And I know that the people who worked on it made efforts to sort of meet with small committees of teachers while they were writing the standards. Ultimately, with a project like that, it was so sweeping and so huge, it was truly impossible for them to get, I think, the level of buy-in that would make this politically viable in every community in all the states that have adopted this thing.
You also, though, in looking at recent history, recent big programs, whether it's Race to the Top or No Child Left Behind, Teach for America, you know, you give historical examples of, you know, going back decades of similar programs that haven't worked. And Teach for America is a perfect opportunity to look at the phone call from Seth and to think about the fact that we want extraordinary teachers, but every time we try to create, you know, a wave of extraordinary teachers, which is a great idea, I go back to what John Dewey said, as you write in your book, in 1895, when he said, education is and forever will be in the hands of ordinary men and women, because we're talking about hundreds of thousands of teachers. And I don't mean to sound defeatist. I just mean most of these programs that seem to try to inspire a wave of super great new teachers hitting the ranks, we have to kind of just come to grips with the fact that that's going to be a small percentage of a very large workforce. Fair to say?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. I mean, this year, Teach for America recruited 5,000 young people into the profession, but 100,000 new teachers were actually hired. So that gives you a sense of the scale that we're talking about. John Dewey's quote about teachers being ordinary men and women, that's, to me, it's not pessimistic, it's optimistic. The reason why is because once we realize that we have to recruit and retain and train this huge mass of people to be teachers, 4% of all civilian workers are teachers, then we have to stop attacking them. We have to stop looking for sort of Superman, down from the heavens, deus ex machina fixes. And instead, what we have to do is help the teachers we already have get better at doing their jobs. And what I suggest is the most powerful way to do that is to get those novice teachers into the classrooms of the expert educators, get them observing and watching what specifically great teaching looks like so they can learn.
Kelly writes in to ask, your guest wants teachers to be paid more. Should teachers in poorer districts be paid more?
Yeah, I think it could make some sense to incentivize teachers to work with, you know, the most high poverty kids by paying them more. Unfortunately, the federal government tried an experiment last year where they were offering $20,000 bonuses to effective teachers to move them to a higher poverty school. Less than a quarter of the teachers who were eligible for that program chose to apply. So that goes to show that I think there's a lot of things about the working conditions in those high-poverty schools that are dissuading people other than pay. That's one of the reasons that I look at the role of the principal. I think that's very important. Teachers aren't going to go take those jobs if they're not going to have a wonderful, supportive principal waiting for them.
And you also, again, we had just touched on when we briefly lost contact with you, we had just touched on your notion of recruiting more men and people of color to the teaching force. And, you know, I don't want to draw too stark a parallel, but in recent weeks we've been talking about the fact of in Ferguson, three minority police officers out of 53 police officers in a town that's 63% black. And you're never going to have a perfect representation, but that is certainly not reflective of the community. And in some communities, there is the sense that that kind of an imbalance can have a negative effect. So give me your explanation for why you want more teachers of color.
Well, I think it's really something that makes sense at the gut level. We know that kids are inspired when they see role models that remind them of themselves. So whether that means a boy looking up to a male teacher, or the actual evidence we have from social science that shows that black teachers are more effective at helping their black students make learning gains, this is very important. We see only about 17% of teachers are people of color, even though we're counting on about 40%. Of our public school kids being children of color. So this is something that needs to be addressed.
Corey in the city, last call for the hour. Go ahead, Corey.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
There's just two really quick things I wanted to bring up. I'm an educator, but I'm also from outside of the country. I'm from Canada. And I've had the opportunity to really take a look at both teaching within the city and also taking a look at it as an outsider. There's something that really needs to be thought of, and two things that really need to be thought of. The first is, if you pull the 2001 census from the Canadian government, you'll find that visible minorities actually graduate higher than their white counterparts, over 51%, graduate university, I should say. And that I'm African Canadian, and I grew up in the black community, and we had a graduation problem, but it was around 80. We were graduating about 85% compared to our white counterparts. And so it was a big issue that we had to sort of take on and deal with. But one of the really big differences, and people have to stop, have to really take this into account, is that when I went to school, when I went to high school, I came from public housing, but yet my person right next to me in the other desk was my pediatrician's daughter. And I can't stress enough how if you concentrate all the poverty within a small amount of schools, it makes it so much harder on that teacher and that system to meet the needs of those students. Any teacher, any great teacher, can handle 5 to 6 kids that might need a little extra help. But when you're actually trying to help, when you're starting to deal with 50%, and I've had students that have gone to have not had stable homes, have been gone to homeless shelters. When you have such a high number, it really makes it a lot more difficult, and it's like we've concentrated all the poverty. And the second thing I really want to bring up as
10 seconds, Corey, go.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that the teachers feed into the suburbs, the same teachers feed into the suburbs as the urban cities. And yet, so the Warner School, which is a great university, I've taught many student teachers from there, they're excellent. And yet, we still have 60% that made effective rating in the city versus, I think it was like 92% in the suburbs. It's not the fact that you're sending bad teachers in there. It's the concentration of poverty. And we really have to approach the social aspects that are associated with that.
I had to let Corey go longer than I wanted, even though we're heading towards the end of the hour, because I thought that was great stuff. And I feel like, Dana, you are probably nodding right along, even though I can't see you,
yeah,
Dana.
Yeah, that was a wonderful final point. I agree totally.
Dana, you're generous with your time. On the day your book is released, The Teacher Wars, so many great lessons, and thank you for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
The book is called The Teacher Wars. It is out now. You can find it just about everywhere. We appreciate Dana's time. Corey, email me separately if you could. I'd like to continue the conversation about your experience. Email me separately here at WXXI because that was very, very interesting stuff there. Great conversation this hour. Short break and back with more with you next on Member Supported Public Radio.